Well, if it's the sports section you're looking for, you are right on time. We talk lacrosse, we talk baseball, we talk softball, we talk playoffs, and we remember Dave Vellone all tonight on the sports section. And, of course, you know when it starts, right? Now. Maybe. Audio not coming up. Okay. So what we do is we do a slight little revision. And we go to this. Oh. Much better. Okay, with that problem solved, good evening and welcome to the sports section, Long Island's longest running call-in sports program. And Matt Mankiewicz and Kevin Broderick in the studio. George Kratzis will be joining us a little bit later. And also at 10 p.m., a meeting of the alumni of the WSB Sports Department, remembering our longtime friend and fellow sportscaster, Dave Vellone, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 58. Yes, when I say that, yes, same age as me. Yes, join the station, same time as me, along with Dave Mollo, who we'll be hearing from as well in that middle hour. But two things, two orders of business to cover before we go into the Seawolves discussion that Kevin and I always do. And number one is Radiothon. It is right smack in the middle of it. And you can make a pledge by doing one of two things. One, making a pledge on WSB.fm. And for $15, you'll get a WSB mug, $25, a baseball cap. I'm wearing one right now, or actually I have it off, but it's there. $50 a WSB t-shirt, $75 a sweatshirt, $90.10, 3 out of 4, 107.3, all of it. Well, also, recurring pledges, $5 a month, $60 a year, get charged your credit card, you won't even notice it. Regardless, we rely on small contributions from lots of people to keep this station operating at top efficiency. Yes, the undergraduate student government contributes a fair portion of our operating budget, but not all of it. And one thing that they don't cover necessarily is the rent on the transmitter, which is off campus. And that has to go on this big high antenna in order for us to reach you in the traditional method. Now, of course, if you're doing it online, you don't care about that. But still, We have to maintain this beautiful studio that we put together 7 years ago. And yes, it does require some maintenance, requires some attention. So that's where the budget goes. That's where the money goes. But the beauty of it is that because nobody actually puts any of it in their pockets, we don't need a lot to operate. So we rely on small pledges. So you got one? You got some money burning a hole in your pocket? Please send it our way. Once again, you can send it via WSB.FM. Now, if you want to make a pledge on the phone, I recommend that you, well, first of all, to get on the air, 631-632-9872, 631-632-WSB. Can't take the pledge live, unfortunately, so we do recommend you do it online because we're live on the air talking, you can't do it. But you can do it 24/7. That's the beauty of it. You can always go back on. And if you're listening online, so much the better. Okay, so once that's out of the way, let's talk. And, Kevin, the first thing we do have to talk about is the women's lacrosse team continuing their dominant ways. And not only that, just a week or two ago, it seems like 2 weeks ago, it's actually only a week and a half, Ellie Massera sat out 2 games.
Yeah.
And the official word was for rest. And I was concerned that the rest would turn to rust. Well, I was totally wrong and very happy to be.
I mean, Ellie Massera, she could have willed her team to that victory. Like, if in a world in which the Seawolves weren't as dominant as they were, Ellie Massera honestly could carry this team by herself. Thank God she doesn't have to, and that's never the conversation that we have, but that's just the kind of player that she is. So, I mean, listen, as a teammate of hers, I would imagine you would have to feel so confident knowing that she can get you a goal when you need it. She can get you anything, really, when you need it. She can clear it so, so easily. I mean, there's really just not enough you can say about her. I mean, that 7-goal performance, 7 goals against the second-best team in the CAA, against Matt, and I don't know if you know this, the second-highest save percentage, the Drexel's goaltender had the second-highest save percentage going into that game in the nation, and Ellie Massera lights her up for 7.
That is, well, first of all, that's got to go down, add to her resume, add to her Towariton resume, okay? And, yes, the dominant player that she is, 11 points total.
Yeah.
7 goals, 4 assists, which is, it's not the absolute record. No, 12 points, correction, 7 goals and 5 assists, correction on that. And that's one shy of the Stony Brook single game record of 13, which was done by Claire Peterson over 10 years ago. But she had 2 goals and 11 assists, which is incredible in and of itself. But her 12-point outing tied Taryn Oldmiller versus Rutgers back on May 16th of 2021, and that was in an NCAA tournament game. And Kylie Oldmiller versus Bryant on February 18th, 2017, second most points in a single game by a Stony Brook player in program history, 13 draw controls. Okay, her second most in the game, the most she recorded since she recorded is career-high 17 against Villanova back on March 2nd. So all Ellie all the time, and you know what? Great. I mean, look, she's been very selfless in that she will, you know, hang out on the left side and draw 2 defenders for Caitlin Hart to go crazy. This time she went off on her own, and she just basically said, hey, Towariton people, I'm here.
I mean, yeah, this is why you send 2 people to guard Ellie, or the alternative is that you actually just end up pressing 1 person on her the entire time, which is the route that Rutgers decided to go. Didn't work out too well for them because, again, like you said, then you have Caitlin Hart running in from the right side of the goal line extended, or you have Alex Finn finding someone in front of the net. So, again, there's no real ways to properly shut down this woman's offense unless you just have the defense to match it. And, of course, the top teams in the nation are going to have those defenses. But still, the trio of Massera, Finn, and Hart, they can light up anyone if they're having their game, if they're having their way. And, I've said it on broadcast a couple of times now, Matt, but Verhulst, she deserves her own denomination in the offensive scoring. She's not quite at the level as the big three, but after those big three, Verhulst is very much the fourth best scorer, and there's a big gap between her and then everyone else on the team.
This is true, although in the previous game, we had 11 different scores, but again, that game was one-sided. But the most important thing here is that Verhulst has another role that she's been doing her pretty much by herself the entire season.
And doing it well against good teams.
Taking the draw control at the face-off X. And look, Ellie gets draw controls because Verhulst sends the ball her way.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's the weird part of women's lacrosse draw controls. It's a very different art than any other kind of face-off or opening possession like a tip-off in basketball. It's actually probably most comparable to the tip-off in basketball. So you think about how, you know, you have your two centers that go into the middle and then they tip the ball back.
Right.
So in women's lacrosse, if you had Chris Mido jump up and tip the ball back and finds Aaron Clark in the backcourt, Aaron Clark, under women's lacrosse rules, would get credited with that possession. Now, it doesn't make a whole ton of sense. I feel like there would probably be better ways to, you know, record that kind of statistic. But regardless, Verhulst, every time that Massera, almost every time Massera gets the ball, it's easy. It's clean because she's so good at it.
Exactly. But like with basketball, when the ball is tipped, especially at center court, now, of course, you still only have jump balls in the NBA, and those are becoming rarer, too. But when the ball is tipped, very rarely does the person tipping the ball get the ball. And I think that's one of the reasons why the draw controls are ruled that way, because when the draw control goes in the air, yes, you do see some players come up with clean wins, but that's relatively rare compared to what happens once the ball is in play.
Mm-hmm.
And that means your wingers on the faceoff circle, they're the ones who are responsible for getting the ball. That's why you have the ground ball vacuum cleaner, Claire Levy, and you have Ellie Massera working that.
Now, Matt, we are going to go through women's lacrosse a bit quicker because I believe George is getting ready to join to talk some baseball and softball.
Okay.
And we will get into men's lacrosse after that. But I'm leaving more time for men's lacrosse because this is going to be a more in-depth discussion.
Yeah, because this is a problem. The men's lacrosse team, in case you're wondering, in case you haven't been following, the men's lacrosse team are in trouble.
Yes, and we will go through. I already have tiebreaker rules from the CAA pulled up. I will pull up the Fairfield schedule. I will pull up Drexel's schedule. I will pull up Mama's schedule, and we will run down everything that has to happen in addition to actually going through the most recent game against Delaware. But obviously not quite done with women's lacrosse because they had a very eventful week. 3 games, 3 wins. You kind of expected it. Rutgers got a bit close, Matt, but in the end, they pulled it out, and they didn't falter like they did last year.
That, I think, remember what we said last week, that this was the game that we're circling. This is the game that will show us what this team is made out of.
I will make a different point about that in a second, but continue.
Because that was the game that kind of did their season in last year.
Yes.
And yes, they recovered. Yes, they won. Yes, they swept through the CAA and all that. But they weren't quite the same. I mean, they kind of, well, I wouldn't say they were exposed. I will say that it kind of took the wind out of their sails a little bit,
mm-hmm.
that they weren't as invincible as they thought they were. And I think that they went into this game saying, that's not going to happen again.
Yeah. No, and it looked like that.
And, yeah, even though Rutgers is the bomb of the Big Ten. Rutgers is not very good this year. So the Seawolves definitely did take advantage.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, but they still...
But not very good in the Big Ten means you're still pretty good compared to the rest of the country.
They had great players, and I think Stony Brook, I think they relaxed a little bit towards that fourth quarter, and that's why it got so close. Additionally, they
Five in a row.
Yeah, they just got lit up in the draw control. So, again, lacrosse is a game of streaks. It's going to happen, but what matters is that in the end, they stabilized, they got better. And one thing that you do have to mention is that Claire Levy is hurt right now. Non-contact knee injury. X-rays came up positive, but nonetheless, she's going to be out for a little bit of time. So
That literally hurts.
That, yeah. Now, I will say that it's not as bad as it could be because Avery Hines is having a breakout season, and I'm talking about leading the team in draw and ground balls and cause turnovers. I mean, in all honesty, going into next year, she might be a Torton watchlist candidate herself. She is having an outstanding season, and I think should be considered one of the best defenders in the nation right now.
Well, that's good because now's her time to step in.
Exactly, and she has been. She's been filling some bigger shoes. So once you get Levy back in there, it gets all of them much better. I don't think this is going to be a Blake Bellin type of injury where she is going to miss the remainder of the season. I think she can recover from this. Obviously, Athletics is a little, holds their cards close to their chest. They're
always
not,
have.
Not giving away too much, so I can't say that with any kind of emphasis behind it. But from what was said, it sounds like it's not the end of the world. Because, again, with Blake Bellin, we knew he was going to be out the rest of the season.
Well, here's the thing, too, is that, there, first of all, there's not a lot of season left, number one.
Yes.
A 2 week, being out 2 weeks, you're already in the playoffs. So, if she's back in time for that, great. If she's back in time for the NCAA, great. Assuming, of course, that they make the NCAA, which, look, we have to always look at one game at a time. And, you know, one bad day, especially in the playoffs, could do your season in. That is a fact, that no matter how good you are.
Yeah.
But we can also look at their past, their track record so far. And we can also say that, you know, their chances are really, really good they're going to make the NCAA.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but we'll always qualify that. If present trends continue, that this is what, that she would be ready for a first round NCAA contest. If. But in case she isn't, there are people backing her up. That's the thing we can count on.
And sorry, just last point before we go into baseball, because we officially have George in the Zoom. Stanford. That's, instead of Rutgers, Matt, I think that's the game we should have been highlighting, because Stanford right now is inside of the top 25. They're at number 18, so
right.
Stony Brook getting another game against a top opponent, and just so happens to be their last game of the season, so that's going to be able to boost them back up in the standings.
Right.
That's where I'm looking at, where Stony Brook just pull out a dominant win before the CAA championship, and you might find yourselves moving up a few spots, and then all of a sudden you could win the CAA championship on top of it and have a lot of momentum going into the NCAA tournament.
Now, also, one last thing before we go to George. Drexel was the only other undefeated team in the CAA going into this weekend's action, weren't they?
Going into this weekend's action, Stony Brook, Drexel, and Hofstra were all undefeated. Drexel and Hofstra both now lost a game, so Stony Brook the only remaining undefeated team.
There we go. So they have tiebreakers over everybody.
Yes.
Okay, George, how you doing? Welcome. Okay, gotcha. Okay, you're up. Okay, so George, where do you want to begin? You know, because both baseball and softball had great weekends. Softball's won 10 in a row, and baseball went on the road and took 2 out of 3. So, let's...
Against Campbell?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't check. I thought they were going to get blown out.
They blew them out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about.
So, on one side of it, we've got a team beating the defending conference champions, and on the other side of it, we have a team beating arguably a top 25 team in the country, not anymore. Arguably, definitely the best offense in the conference. So, your pick.
I think you guys start with Campbell.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's start with Campbell.
Okay. For some reason, you're not coming in. Oh, there we go. Okay. No, that's me. Sorry.
Matt's just trying to fix something.
I'm trying
quick,
to fix
George.
Something. Yeah, keep talking. Go ahead.
Right, so big weekend, obviously. I mean, when was I on? Maybe 2 weeks ago after the Charleston series. And I said, well, you know, one will be a test, but their real test will be in 2 weeks when they have Campbell. We were talking about how it would be big to salvage a game.
Yeah.
And then Campbell's lucky to have salvaged a game.
Yeah, what do the standings look like now because of that?
So now it's kind of all jumbled up because now Campbell is 6-6, Stony Brook is 6-6, and I believe Delaware is 6-6. So after Northeastern, Wilmington, William and Mary, and I believe NCAT, it becomes kind of a crapshoot after that.
All right. Well, I mean, then I would just say get into the games then, because I want to hear what happened.
Yes, I was... Oh, Charleston's also up there. And NCAT has actually started losing after conference play started, so I stand corrected. So there is a three-way tie for fifth place. So
what you have to do now is you look in CAAsports.com and look who they – look all those teams, because you got that logjam right now. And you have to look at who they face, who's left for them to face in the rest of the schedule, because we're getting close. I mean, we're mid-April now. And
well,
go ahead.
I think one thing that you have to think about when you talk about Stony Brook, they're not going to see Wilmington and they're not going to see NCAT, who, say what you will about NCAT, but they're still kind of in the thick of it, and Wilmington's obviously the best team in the conference. They've played their hard games, with the exception of Northeastern the last weekend of the year.
Right.
They've played Charleston, they've played William and Mary, they've played Campbell, and they took care of Campbell. So now it's the Delaware series, I believe, in 3 weeks.
Got Monmouth, Hofstra, and then Delaware. Towson, Monmouth, Hofstra, and Delaware in that order.
Towson, if they don't sweep, they have a bigger problem in their hand.
Yeah, Towson isn't any good.
And Monmouth, they realistically should sweep. And Hofstra, they should bare minimum take 2 of 3.
That sets them up for the stretch run. Now, because of the logjam, you don't necessarily know if they're going to have a playoff spot nailed down. Because, I mean, even when you look at the top teams like UNCW, Northeastern, and Charleston has shown a little bit of vulnerability too. I mean, they've been rolling lately, but... I mean, I'm looking at right now at UNC Wilmington, who they've got coming up. They got Northeastern next weekend. They got William and Mary and Campbell and Hofstra in Delaware. So,
sorry, who is that has Northeastern next weekend?
That is UNCW.
Okay.
So they're going the top two teams going to go head to head next weekend for Charleston. On the other hand, okay,
and who's home? Who's home in that series?
Good question. Let me just double check that. Open up Wilmington,
so it's
again.
In Boston.
It is, yeah. It is in Brookline. Yep. There you go. At Northeastern.
It's going to be a very good series, and it's going to probably tell us a lot about where this conference is going.
And William and Mary is I believe, right behind them. Okay, because Charleston's got William and Mary at home next weekend. And then they got to go to Campbell, which is not a big long trip for them. Then they can beat up on Towson. But then they got Northeastern again. I mean, they've got Towson and Elon in their schedule, but they've got Campbell, Northeastern, William and Mary coming up.
And Elon is a really, like, I'm not going to say they're good, but Elon is a really good 4-8 team.
Well, Elon can hit. We've definitely seen that. But
we've seen that they can't pitch.
Yeah, but the only team they can't hit against is Stony Brook, because they scored a total of, what, 6 runs against them in 3 games?
Something like
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
18-2, 9-1, 6-3.
Right.
And then they lost 12-0 in East Carolina to follow it, but they swept Hofstra this weekend.
So maybe Hofstra's showing vulnerability now. So maybe that is going to become a must-sweep series as well.
Hofstra's a 3-9, yeah.
If they can... I mean, obviously, baseball is one of those sports where you're not going to, like, start guaranteeing wins. But if they can go 9-0 against Monmouth, Towson, and Hofstra, even if they can go 8-1, they're in a really good spot.
Oh, no doubt about it. That would vault them up into the top four easily, I think, because of the fact that so many tough games are coming up in the schedule for the top three teams. Top four right. teams, I should say.
William and Mary will be humbled at some point. Charleston will be humbled at some point. And UNCW and Northeastern will beat up on each other.
Right. This coming weekend.
Right. And Campbell can hit. Campbell, when I was previewing and looking at the games, I was saying, yes, they can hit, but they cannot pitch. Like, they are genuinely one of the worst pitching teams.
Well, based on what they did, they beat Stony Brook 9-2 in the middle game, but they lost 7-3 and lost 11-2. So Stony Brook teed off on them pretty good.
Even that middle game, Nick Rizzo went 2 2/3 innings and gave up 2 runs. And then after that, Sank really just showed no desire to use any of his relievers. He just left Colin Ryan out there for 3 2/3 or something.
That's a tough call. I mean, look, I understand especially in these weekend series. And look, in three-game series, weekend series in the major league level, it happens too. What do you do? Do you try to dig yourself out of the hole? Also depends on what pitching they're facing. And remember, they scored only two runs against Campbell. So whoever they were facing, unfortunately, I didn't see the game, was good. So he's probably thinking, you know what? Do what we can here, but our position is much better on Sunday. Let's save everything for Sunday. I can understand that point of view if that indeed was what he was thinking.
And another thing that I would like to kind of take into account, Friday night they were up, I believe, 4-0, and they had Eric Paulson, who's been their best reliever all year, they had him up in the bullpen, and they didn't want to sit him down since he was already up for a 4-0 game. Then when they make it 7-0, they're kind of forced their hand to bring him in.
Yeah.
Although I think, looking back on it, you really don't want Paulson pitching in a 7-0 game.
But that's unavoidable. I mean, how many times have teams brought their closer up, in the top of the ninth inning to pitch the bottom, on the road, in the top of the ninth to pitch the bottom half, and they put some extra runs in the top half, and it's not a safe situation anymore.
Right. But I think he would have liked to have Eric available on Saturday. Not that it necessarily would have made a difference, because they lost 9-2, obviously. But it's just something. Like, I think, realistically, if you want to go the Colin Ryan, Ty Panarello, Quinlan Montgomery route, you much rather would have used that in the 7-0 game on Friday versus when it was a little closer and you're fighting for runs on Saturday.
Right. And on Saturday, well, you know what? They only scored two. So I have to take a look at the box score, but whoever they faced and whatever combination of pitchers they faced was really good.
Yeah, and Friday was a tough game because it seemed Saturday was a tough game. So Friday night, any break that could go Stony Brook's way went their way. Saturday was the complete opposite. They're getting guys on second and third, lining out to the third baseman. And then Campbell will come up and hit a little squibber and run it out. Or the wind will take a ball and a pop-up becomes a three-run homer.
Yeah.
So, and then Sunday, I guess it all evened out.
Well, Sunday was actually a tight game until the late innings.
Right. I was watching that game with Mike in the Statesman office today, and we were talking about how, okay, JT Rabb goes 6 2/3. Where are you going to close this game out? And then they put on extra runs, and that became a non-issue.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, a couple of breaks did go their way, but we were expecting Campbell to be a very – well, Campbell still is a very dangerous team. And a welcome addition to the CAA, definitely, because it makes the whole league better.
And the one thing that Stony Brook kind of lucked out in, Campbell was without Grant Nipp this weekend, their catcher, who's a Golden Spikes midseason watch list player. He's got an OPS nearing 2,000, 15-something home runs. He hasn't played in, I think, 3 weeks. So, and they're saying he might come back this week for a midweek. So Stony Brook just barely lucked out in missing him.
Well, that midweek is against NC State.
Right. That's what the Flow Sports broadcast was talking about.
Yeah, and then they've got Hofstra. They're coming up here to play Hofstra.
Which, realistically, they shouldn't have any issue with.
Right. Then, but it is an interesting. I love their midweek games. Obviously, because they're located in Buies Creek, North Carolina. NC State's a short trip for them, and that's on the road. Duke comes to them. They have a midweek game against Liberty. They have a midweek game at Chapel Hill against North Carolina. They have a midweek game against East Carolina, which is actually a pretty good team. So, their non-conference schedule, even their midweek games, are actually pretty tough. Even though they got mauled by Duke last time they faced them.
And that's what I was talking about with Mike. Because their midweek schedule is so hard, if they find themselves in the conference finals or even the semifinals at this point, they might get an at-large.
Yeah. Well, their performance against these teams, let's also take a look at their midweek games. They got beat on by Duke. Charleston Southern, they won handily. Lafayette, they beat handily. North Carolina, they lost to earlier, but they get another crack at them. Coastal Carolina, they lost 9-2. East Carolina, they beat 7-6. And all of these, except for Coastal Carolina, they face again. So they get another crack at North Carolina, another crack at Duke. They go to Liberty, and they get another crack at East Carolina.
Right, but East Carolina's ranked, or at least was when they beat them. They took 2 of 3 from UCSB, who's still ranked.
Yep.
Like,
although that opened the season back in February,
You talk about the discrepancy. Stony Brook is taking midweeks from Fordham and Iona, and these guys are taking midweeks against East Carolina.
Right.
That's the difference.
But that's geography, too. It sort of can't be helped because everybody needs the midweek games. So, you know, they're all, you know, I mean, it's kind of like Maryland in lacrosse where, you know, Hopkins doesn't have to venture too far to play Loyola or Navy or Maryland. It's the same situation where they're geographically very close, but North Carolina just happens to be loaded with power conference schools.
Right, and that's not to say anything bad about Stony Brook. They're doing well with what they can deal with.
Right.
But when it comes to an at-large bid, you're going to take a team that's been playing Duke and UNC and NC State all year versus Iona, Siena, Fordham, St. John's, whoever.
Well, that's always been the knock on Northern teams as well because, when Stony Brook got to the College World Series in 2012, a Northern team hadn't been there in a very long time. And, the Big Ten had not sent a team. I think Indiana got in, I think, the year after Stony Brook did. But no Big Ten team had been to the College World Series prior to that since 1984. So you're talking about 30 years. And it's just be the fact that they play up north. And some people are going so far to say that we had an unusually warm winter. That's why all the Northern teams did so well. Whatever. In any case, yes. The Southern teams have that little advantage that they get to play each other a lot more because it's easier to get to.
Yeah. And like I said, that's not a knock on Stony Brook. It's just dealing with the cards they've been dealt.
Exactly.
But it's something to think about.
Oh, anyway. No doubt about it. But it also means that this is where it gets a little crazier. I mean, look, we've said the same thing. It's the opposite in women's lacrosse in the CAA, where Stony Brook's non-conference schedule is tougher because Joe Spolina realized it had to be in order to get any kind of respect whatsoever from the NCAA selection committee. Because if you take a look at the top teams in the CAA, their non-conference schedules are nowhere near as tough as Stony Brook's.
Drexel had a kind of impressive one, but that's a side point.
Yeah, but you take a look at Towson, theirs isn't.
Yeah, no one else.
Yeah, but so I can understand that, too. Now, in the future, what does that mean for Stony Brook? Again, when you're scheduling non-conference, you're usually going down there. You schedule tougher non-conference teams, absolutely, when you go down there, go down south. But the midweek, you get Seton Hall. But you play the weekend series with them. It took 2 out of 3, which is nice. A Big East team, but Big East in baseball is not ACC, okay? You're dealing with the geographic reality. You're not going to necessarily get NC State and North Carolina to come up to play us midweek or us to go down there.
Right. So now that Kevin's back, do we want to kind of recap what happened? Because I know he was talking.
Yeah, let's do that. Because especially that first game I am pleasantly surprised because I thought this was going to be a very tough series for the Seawolves, especially on the road.
Yeah, and you look at Friday's game, like, it had everything going against it for them. Obviously, Campbell's pitching staff is not anything special. I would not call them good to begin with. but that's besides the point. The game was delayed an hour and a half due to lightning and rain.
Oh my God.
That's not what you want with your ace on the mound. You don't want him getting affected by that. And he did kind of look affected. You know, he threw Eddie Smink threw six scoreless innings, but at the same time, he scattered six walks and a hit by pitch. So not what you necessarily want from your starter, but at the same time, they were six shutout innings. The offense scored. They hit 10 hits, a couple home runs. Brett Paulson had two huge hits. You know, we've talked about his struggles this year.
Mm-hmm.
But he really has come up big for them when they do need him. And he happened twice in that Friday game with runners on second and third. He got balls through the infield to bring in a couple runs each.
I'm impressed with Johnny Pilla and Chris Carson. Both, one's a sophomore, one's a freshman. Okay, Pilla hits a home run. Carson, you know, goes 1-for-3, and he had a home run too. So, I mean, good. The young guys, they're contributing top to bottom. That's what you want to see.
Me and George personally love Johnny Pilla.
Pilla's had a great year. When we talked to Sank before the season, it was kind of a, well, he can hit, but what's the deal with his defense? Where is he going to play? That type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then when other guys start not hitting, talking about guys like Evan Goforth, he kind of gets forced, his hand gets forced, and next thing you know, Johnny Pilla is playing every day, and he's played well. You know, he's hitting 258, but he's hit for power. He walks a ton. It feels like every time I'm watching him, he's in a 3-2 count. Doubles and three home runs this year. So half his hits are extra base hits, practically.
Which also means that Evan Fox can play third because of it.
And obviously you don't want Evan Fox playing third in an ideal world.
Yeah, his natural position is second, but in the absence of anybody else who can play third, he fills in pretty well.
Yeah, he can do it. He hasn't made an error there yet, to my knowledge. But he does make routine plays look tricky. And he does make plays at first look closer than they should be. Which, you know, he's not a third baseman, so you can't knock him that much for that.
Well, I mean, it's always a case of the old Jeter versus A-Rod. You know, you got two shortstops. Which one's going to, you know, which one's going to play? And A-Rod got the nod at third because he had the stronger arm than Jeter. Yeah. So, same situation. Fox has to move because Fox can play third and Pilla can't.
Yeah, and from what Sank told us, they experimented with Johnny at third in the fall, and it wasn't really a successful experiment, so they just decided to keep him at second. Seems like it's working. I don't think I'm crazy in saying that.
It is. And the other thing that I'm glad we had... That's the only defensive problem that we've mentioned, and it isn't really that much of a problem because outs are outs. And that, I think, is a big step up. And Mike, of course, was saying that last year, that defensively the Seawolves weren't necessarily what you expect from a Matt Sank team. You're, like I said, outs are outs. And you're getting especially good play in the outfield. That, you know, balls in the gap get caught.
Yeah, the outfield play has been good. It's like Matty Wright had a tough weekend at the plate, but he is so good in right field. And, you know, Cam Santier hasn't played much, but he's been good when he's played in center. Or I should say he hasn't played much the last two weekends just because of matchups. He's been good in center field when he's out there. He's just an incredible athlete, so fast. I was watching today, and I was impressed by how quick he is. Matt Brown-Herring, you know, you might get distracted by the fact that he's leading the team in home runs and slugs a ball 400 feet, but he's a really good fielder, and he's really deceivingly fast.
Mm-hmm.
So defensively, they're, I mean, the fifth best team in the conference by fielding percentage. So,
which doesn't let the side down. I mean, this team is not going to be tops in any category, no. But they're going to be good enough.
Well, they're top five in they're fifth in ERA.
Yeah, but there you go, mid pack again.
Top five is a playoff team, though.
Exactly, top six is a playoff team.
Yeah.
So, and that's That's why you like, and everything we've said, your schedule down the stretch is fairly easy with the exception of Northeastern to end the season. You don't want to be in a position where you have to take two out of three from Northeastern to make the playoffs. So you really, again, with the old make hay while the sun shines adage, you really have to wail on teams like Towson and Monmouth and Hofstra and Delaware, yeah, too.
And the other thing to keep in mind that I brought up to Mike, Northeastern will have clinched a spot by then.
This is also true.
That's the last weekend of the year. We might not see their ace. We might not see their better players playing.
But on the other hand, there is necessarily want to lay down for Stony Brook either.
Right. And there's the conversation about, well, if there's seeding in play.
That's all, yes.
But I don't know that they would throw. And that's the thing with Stony Brook. Eddie Smink, we think, is kind of pitching hurt. So if they clinch a spot by then, he'll definitely be rested that Friday.
Yeah.
Evan Fox has been nursing an injury all year. He might be sitting at that point. So there's a lot of baseball to be taken care of before Northeastern. But I think they're in a good spot to make that series kind of less important than it looks right now.
And the important thing here is that we believe in this room and where you're sitting right now that every team except for Northeastern, the Seawolves are better than.
Yeah. Delaware is going to be a good fight because Delaware also took 2 of 3 from Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
But Delaware suffers the same reality as Campbell in that they can't pitch. And good pitching will always be good hitting.
And bad pitching will be beaten by good hitting.
Bad pitching will be beaten by bad hitting.
Yeah. But then, again, the Seawolves have continued to surprise us because they've gotten the hitting. And the impression that I've... they've gotten the hitting. It's not going to necessarily show up on the stats, in the cumulative stats, but things that you brought up perfectly, like Johnny Pilla drawing a lot of walks, guys putting the ball in play, you know, making conscious efforts to slap a ball through the right side, situational hitting, knowing what to do in the situation that you're in. That, I mean, like I said, that's what Matt Sank teaches, but we didn't see a lot of that last year. We see much more of it this year.
I mean, they're getting contributions from, and that's what I think is the biggest thing. Like, Ryan Michelli on paper does not look like he's having a good year. But week in and week out, he's coming up with timely hits. Even if they're singles, he's coming up with timely hits. Matt Maselli was not a good hitter coming into this year. This year he's hitting .281, second on the team with 20 RBIs. Played every inning for them this year.
That is situational hitting. That's exactly what you're looking for in his situation, that he's not going to lead you an average, but he's going to knock runs in.
Cam Santier has a .470 on base percentage. Yes, he's hitting .290. That's very good. But a .470 on base percentage.
And he's being platooned.
He's not playing every day, and he's still having a .470 on base percentage.
Yeah. It's a better team. It's still not necessarily at Northeastern's level, but it took a big step forward, and that's the other thing. When you're in the situation that the Seawolves were in last year, especially when you were worried about who was going to leave via the transfer portal, and you're still worried about that. We're going to talk about that, I think, after the season ends a lot more, because we're going to get some surprises in both directions. Some may stay that we thought should leave. Some may leave that we thought should stay. But the state of the baseball program at the end of last season was rather dismal. They didn't make the playoffs. They were liable to lose guys in the transfer portal, and they did lose one, but he's not really doing much at Coastal Carolina, Josh O'Neill. But
and they lost one to Elon.
Yeah.
He's not doing very much, and Elon is a bottom dweller.
Exactly. So,
and they blew him out every single time he played here.
Right.
That three-game series wasn't close in the slightest.
Yeah, so you have to make an argument here that, yes, everybody loses players to the transfer portal, but you got to wonder, if how much of an impact did they have here, and how much of an impact will they have where they're going? And look, I'm a firm believer getting what you can while you can, and those guys, if they've got better deals down there or they just like the weather down there, whatever reason they made for transferring out, I have to respect it. But on the other hand, we also know that we have – that you lose – he who lives by the transfer portal dies by a transfer portal and vice versa. So you get guys, you lose guys. The question is, you know, how much – when you sell the Stony Brook program to people, you have a lot of good points to it. And the one major good point that I've always believed is just take a look at what this team has been able to do simply by learning, simply by developing, simply by just the individual guys on the team getting better. And that, if you're a kid coming out of high school and you're being courted by a lot of these teams on Stony Brook's level, you have to start to wonder, you know, maybe I will develop better as a player if I go to Stony Brook. I will get an education, but I'll also get an education on the diamond, which is, I think, is very important because it can allow you, if you, especially if you are a talent that maybe, you know, just marginal draft material could put you over the top.
Yeah, so you mentioned you're going to get transfers in both directions. I don't think it's a stretch to say losing Shane Paradine but gaining Cam Santier from the transfer portal. I don't think that's such a bad thing looking back on it.
No, I don't either. I mean, the way that – and Cam Santier filled a need, a real need, yeah, in the outfield. And – While of course, you know, Chris Carson has worked his way in, they were going to – Cam Santier, being in the season, when was your ride or die in center field. It's just how the way – another player developed and another player got better. That's a little bit different. It's now a platoon.
Yeah, they kind of have an embarrassment of riches in that they have four legitimate guys that could fill two spots in center and right field. So it seems like the plan is going to be – Santier in center, Rob Taylor in right against left-handed pitching, and Matty Wright and Chris Carson. Carson in center, right in right against righties. So they're in a good spot outfield-wise, and you know now they don't need to put Evan Fox in center field.
That's another thing. He did play a couple of games early on there.
And now they can stick him... Ideally at second, but it seems like he's going to be at third now.
Nah, he's got to stay at third because, like we said, we've got somebody now with Johnny Pilla who's been effective at that position. And putting Fox back at second leaves a hole at third. Leaving things the way they are, you've got an infield that you can work with.
Absolutely. I mean, Fox isn't going to be an incredible fielder over there, but he'll get the job done, which is better than what they were having earlier in the year.
It's happened. There have been situations like that. I'll go back 50 plus years, and we do have to I'll make this quick because we have to cover softball. 50 plus years to the 1968 World Series. The Detroit Tigers, behind Denny McClain, won 31 games. Everybody knows all that wonderful stuff. But their starting shortstop batted 135. His name was Ray Euler. So they bring Mickey Stanley in from center field to play short during the World Series. Was he as good a shortstop as Euler? No, but he was a way better hitter. And he was just effective enough to end up winning that series. He wasn't the main reason why. It was Mickey Rolos winning three games. But he didn't let the team down either.
Yep. I mean, sometimes you have to make those sacrifices, move people around.
Absolutely, but that's a perfect example of it. Yeah, I mean, there'll be more of that, I'm sure, coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. But in any case, let's talk about softball because they've won 10 in a row.
Yeah, 11 in a row, actually.
Okay, so I missed today's game.
So they beat Hofstra 7-1.
Mm-hmm.
Timely hitting in the first, obviously 7-1, they won that game by a big margin. But the first two games, timely hitting. Game one, obviously I had my hands full with baseball this weekend, but from what I heard, seventh inning of game one, down to their last out, Catherine Ann Kapinski two-run double, or two-run single, to tie the game, and then Corinne Badger, an RBI knock, to win that one. And then I didn't check up on Saturday's game so much, but now I'm looking at it. So they beat Hofstra's ace, who was the best pitcher in the conference. They beat her twice, it looks like. They beat her in all three games. She had an ERA of 1.21 entering the series.
Oh, that's doubled.
They beat her three times. Once again, it was CA with a two-run knock to take a 4-3 lead in the seventh inning of game two. And then today, Corinne Badger, two-run double. Kira McFarland, a two-run inside-the-park home run. First career home run, I believe. So, I mean, they're firing on all cylinders, and the pitching was a big question mark coming into this season. Seems like they've figured out their pitching.
Well, Mia Haynes, going before this, they really started to take off in this winning streak, was a 500 pitcher.
Yeah, Mia Haynes, and just from what Mike told me, obviously last year I wasn't keeping up with Stony Brook softball, she's a notoriously slow starter in that she takes a while to get going, and now we saw the same thing this year in that she struggles 4 runs, 5 runs, 3, 6 in her first few starts. But since then, it's 0-1, 0-3, 0-0, 2-1. Like, she's turning in consistently ace-type outings, which is really all you can ask for from her. And then Gabrielle Mayday has been a godsend for this team. Just to have a second reliable starter and then Ashton Milos coming out of the bullpen, to have a sub-4 ERA from your 2 starter, and then to have Milos pitch well as well, is really just, again, I'm not going to try to overuse the term embarrassment of riches, but they have a lot going for them. And I think, you know, we talk about teams entering the playoffs hot. They are hot right now.
Well, the other thing, too, is that Ashton Milos was, before Mayday came in, your 1 and your 2 were Haynes and Milos. And yeah. Haynes was basically the pitcher that you used in the playoffs last year, and they had a pretty deep run, but they didn't have any depth after her, which is really one of the reasons why they weren't able to win the championship. But she has emerged as the number one. Now, is she as dominant as, let's say, Dawn Bodrick was before her? No, but she has been as lights out as you could possibly expect otherwise. I mean, she's not going to throw no-hitters every day. But she's going to keep you in the game, and you have an offense that can capitalize. And that's one of the reasons why this team is so competitive. It's why it's gotten so hot.
Yeah, this offense started slow, partially because Corinne Badger was hitting under 200 for the good part of the year, and now has woken up and started to actually become a complete hitter to go along with the home runs. This offense will carry the team, so their pitching really doesn't need to do much, but their pitching is more than holding their own right now.
I mean, Kira McFarland is batting .410. C.A. Kapinski is .355 right now and with Kapinski 6 home
might
runs.
Player of the year.
Yeah. Corinne Badger's got 6 home runs. You know, I mean, they're getting
base is almost 500, I think.
Yeah.
.443 on base.
So, I mean, yes, they can hit you out of trouble, which is one thing that they really showed last year, too, in that run. But this team is working its way up the standings as a result of it. And they have to be a legitimate threat when the playoffs come around. Now, looking at their schedule, let's look ahead because we do have a few minutes before the 10 o'clock hour. Let's do this. They will, first of all winning streaks eventually do end, and you don't want them to end in the playoffs. Fortunately, the playoffs are double elimination, but still. Fairleigh Dickinson, a midweek doubleheader. You've got Drexel at home coming up. Then you got Elon at home and North Carolina A&T to finish up. And the softball championships, they happen second week in May. So you don't they happen before the baseball. Baseball's Memorial Day, all the way at the end of May. So taking a look, let's also open up the standings, because that's also very important to see where they are right now.
They're not going to play a team better than them until the playoffs.
Right.
Hofstra was the last domino standing in their way, because they got rid of Delaware and Campbell early in the year. They don't play UNCW. Monmouth, they took care of. Towson, they took care of. So now it's just NCAT and Elon and Drexel.
Now, Elon's a 10-8. They're competitive. They're 16-25 overall, but that doesn't matter as much. But, yes, all the teams are below them in the standings right now.
Yeah.
So that could enable them to they're in the four right now, and they're only a game out of the three and only two games out of the two. Delaware is at the top at 16-2.
And Delaware will be at the top.
Yeah.
Delaware is the best team in the conference, not even close.
But, again, they're setting themselves up for a good run, which I like.
Which is the same thing the baseball team is doing.
Well, the baseball, yes, and that's the other thing, too, is that three good pitchers, your three starters are good to carry you through a weekend. But through a double elimination tournament, you need a little more. That's one of the reasons why I say you can't ride your one ace in softball. You need someone else, which is one of the reasons why Mayday is such a huge addition to that softball team, because she is the someone else who can spot Haynes. Go ahead.
I think that's going to be the problem with the baseball team, is that they don't really have a fourth starter. They have Eric Paulson, who's a solid reliever, but they don't have that fourth starter.
Because you're in a position where you may have to play two games in the same day.
Yeah, and they've showed struggles of having enough pitching depth for a weekend, much less one day.
Exactly. And yeah, if you wind up in a loser bracket, I mean, you win three straight, you cruise to the NCAAs, but that's what you have to do. You can't afford find yourself in a loser bracket at any time if you don't have a lot of pitching depth, because once you do, it snowballs. Unless you can bail out. In the entire history of the Stony Brook baseball program, there are only two double elimination series where they advanced after having lost one game. And those happened in 2012.
Yeah. I mean, I've felt that on the high school level. Once you lose that first game, it's just almost impossible to do anything with that.
Yeah. So, they got, yeah, if the Seawolves win, yeah, I mean, this is all obvious. If the Seawolves win, they advance, right? Yeah, but if the Seawolves don't lose in the tournament, again, they will advance. They have what it takes, I think, if things break their way, to do that, and they get lucky. Only problem is, like we've said before, the teams there are significantly better than they are. The ones that, I mean, yes, Charleston definitely beat up on them pretty good, but they have not had to play anybody better, and they do have a little tune-up because they do have Northeastern to end the regular season. So they can see where they stand right there. But even then, if they have a good three games against Northeastern, you still have that situation where not only that, it's going to be one day after the next, especially for your bullpen. And another thing where the Seawolves have advanced is that they've gotten complete games out of people. And again, we're talking about 10 years ago plus, but they've gotten, I mean, I can name Frankie Van Durka, I can name Brandon McNitt, I can name all these guys who came up with complete games in super regionals who were able to get the Seawolves over the top, because even that team did not have that deep a bullpen. When you think about it, they didn't ride their bullpen. They rode their starters. And the starters are good, but the bullpen, you have a couple of guys, but you're going to need more.
Yeah, and Matt, you bring